I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. In recent weeks, the government has been trying to persuade the opposition to back its plan for a plebiscite on same-sex marriage, but without any sign of success. The legislation for the plebiscite is expected now to be defeated in the Senate. The latest news poll, however, has undermined the government's case for the plebiscite. 48% want the issue settled by Parliament, compared with 39% who support a popular vote. Previously, the plebiscite has had strong support. Today, we're joined by Special Minister of State, Senator Scott Ryan. He and Attorney General George Brandis are overseeing the government's push for a national vote. Scott Ryan, you and Senator Brandis this week met with Labor's Mark Dreyfus and Terry Butler to discuss the proposed plebiscite. Yet the meeting ended in a total standoff. Neither side suggested any sort of compromise. Is this now the end of the story?
Well, I hope not, Michelle, and thanks for having me. The meeting was called for a couple of reasons, one of which was I've had a number of meetings with stakeholders to offer them an opportunity to ask questions about the technical nature of the bill, how the vote will proceed, but also to hear from the Labor Party and offer them the opportunity to effectively make suggestions and to say on what terms they would support the bill. I mean, I can't guess what the Labor Party have as their priorities, nor as what they would put as conditions for their support. We've got a very detailed proposal out there, the product of long consultation, a draft bill for a plebiscite which has a lot of all the mechanical issues of the national vote covered. And so really, in the words of the PM, the ball's in Labor's court to actually say this is what we'd like to change to support the plebiscite.
But in practical terms, neither side really can give much ground, can they?
Well, we've made it very clear that we will consider in good faith any proposal that Bill Shorten and the Labor Party bring forward. You know, Bill Shorten did say he didn't have a problem with the plebiscite only a few years ago, and we will consider in good faith, through the processes of the government, if Labor brings something forward. And the meeting was an opportunity for them to, even if they didn't have the power to make formal suggestions, to actually say, these are the terms upon which we want to come back to you in a week or two or a couple of weeks. We've got a proposal out there. It really is up to, you know, the other party to potential negotiations to say, this is how we'd like to proceed.
Now, a betting person would have quite a lot of money on this being now defeated in the Senate. If that, as expected, happens, where does it go from there, or does it go nowhere? Is there no chance of a parliamentary vote this term?
Well, I'm not a betting man, firstly, Michelle. I don't think I'd be very good at it either. but we took an explicit commitment to the election. It was a commitment that, in my view, is one of those that is very clear to the public. It's to have a national vote. It's not something that wasn't the subject of a lot of public debate. So we are committed to legislating for a national vote that will resolve this issue. That's where we're putting our effort at the moment, to seek to persuade, in this case, the meeting the other day, the Labor Party, offer them an opportunity to put forward conditions upon which they'd support it, and just because we haven't had an answer from them yet, so I'm remaining a touch optimistic that I'm hopeful that they may come back with something in the future.
But can you say once and for all that if there's no plebiscite, then this issue can't be reopened by a parliamentary vote before the end of the term?
Well, the government's position, I think, and we've done this on a number of issues, is to stick to the policy we took to the election.
And that'll hold? Well, that's glued in for the whole term.
I think so.
Now, were you surprised at the news poll that suggests that people who were previously very much in favour of the plebiscite are now having second thoughts and saying, well, settle it in Parliament, or at least more are saying that than are saying have the plebiscite?
Look, I've learnt not to be too surprised in politics. But, look, it's one poll. There have been other polls that have said different things. It's not the basis upon which we're putting this case to the Parliament. The prime basis on which we're doing that is this is a commitment we said we would do our best to legislate. We would try and get the ensure the Australian people could have a vote. And importantly, our proposal means that this can be voted on as soon as is practicable, which is the words the Prime Minister said, which is February 11 next year, which means that we do have a rapid path to resolving this issue. It does engage the electorate. It does engage the community. And I think that is the most effective way at ensuring that this issue is resolved.
Now, what about the community affected, the LGBTI community? You've had consultations with them. Their feeling certainly seems to have hardened against a plebiscite. Would you agree with that? And how do you think feeling breaks?
Well, I've met with groups that represent all Australians, and I'm always careful to say that one person that might be a leader of a group doesn't necessarily represent every person within the group they're claiming to represent. That, I'm not meant to dismissing the representatives that I've met at all, but I don't think that any one group within the community on any particular issue that's a subject of democratic debate necessarily has the ability to say, well, we don't think this is path, and then and therefore that opinion is not open to debate. I respect the views of those, and I've listened to them, those who are concerned about the impact of a public debate. I don't agree with them. I think this country is one that has debated difficult issues very well, very effectively, and I'm not going to judge the great majority, overwhelming majority of Australian people who I believe act in good faith because of the acts of a small number that may not express public debate in the terms that the majority find appropriate.
But you would agree that of that community, a majority at the moment is against a popular vote?
Well, of the groups that I have met with, there are views against popular vote, there are views in favour. I have met with people who are in favour of it because they are strongly supportive not only of the process, but also of the fact that this will provide a speedy resolution of the issue. And I will vote yes at the plebiscite. I share the optimism of the Prime Minister about the result of the plebiscite. My job is to provide for a fair plebiscite. I have not had anyone over the last 2 weeks complain that the process reflected in this bill is not objectively, absolutely fair.
If there's no popular vote, do you think the issue will subside for the time being, or do you think that the agitation will be somewhat divisive and an irritant for the government?
With the proviso that I've learnt not to try and predict the future, particularly in politics, I think there's always the risk that if the Labor Party, Bill Shorten said he was okay with a plebiscite only a few years ago for partisan or short-term political purposes, decide to not engage with us and offer up, for example, the terms upon which they would support the plebiscite, even for our consideration, then there is always the risk that it will disappear from the public agenda, even if temporarily. You know, we're going to stick to our policy that we took to the electorate, and I think particularly with a policy like this that was clear, concise, and explicit, and the subject of public debate, that is entirely the appropriate thing for us to do, to try and legislate for this plebiscite.
Now, you also have oversight of the electoral system. Let's turn to that. It's a bit further down the track than your immediate issues with the plebiscite.
But it always interests politicians.
I bet it does. You've announced this broad inquiry into various aspects of the electoral system and political donations, including foreign donations, which have come to the fore of attention recently. Were you surprised at the remarks of the outgoing American ambassador, John Berry, who expressed some concern about the role of Chinese money in Australian politics?
I wouldn't say I was surprised, but I didn't know about them coming, or I didn't expect them. The point you make about foreign donations, I have included a specific reference to the Electoral Matters Committee on this, because there is, in my view, a lack of clarity when this has been debated publicly. For example, despite Labor's promise to legislate on foreign donations, the bill that they had in the Parliament when they were in government would not have covered the political donations that have often been the subject of debate over recent weeks, because they defined it in a certain way. The bill or the proposal brought forward by Andrew Wilkie uses a different definition of what would be a foreign donation and would apply in a very different way. So my specific reference includes foreign persons, foreign entities, foreign donations and foreign-owned subsidiaries. Because, for example, I've never heard a complaint about one of the car manufacturing companies or a large multinational that we might have like General Electric. So the comments of the US ambassador, I think, alluded then to the issue of state influence as opposed to what might be corporate influence. I have no problem with corporate donations in principle, and I think it's important that before this debate proceeds, we are clear about what is the impact of what has been proposed, but more importantly, what specifically is the problem to be identified that people want to deal with through a potential legislative change. We have to identify what a problem is before we legislate to regulate it. And the High Court has made that clear in recent High Court judgments with respect to political donations cases that came out of New South Wales.
In your ideal electoral world, would you prefer foreign donations weren't part of the system, however defined?
Well, I don't think there's a problem with a company like Toyota. I have no idea off the top of my head whether Toyota does make political contributions, but a company
probably not anymore.
Probably it's got decades of involvement in Australia, employs thousands of people, has a large presence. I don't think anyone's got a problem with that, or whether it be another similar foreign-owned multinational with a presence in Australia, and I've worked for one in the past. So I think we have to, again, when it comes to anything to do with electoral matters and restrictions on people's political activity, and restricting donations is a restriction on political activity, that we identify exactly what the problem is that people are seeking to legislate. And one of the other points that I've made when asked about this in Parliament is that I'm not going to participate or support any measure that seeks to create an unfair playing field in political donations or political participation. And the ludicrous position of the Greens to ban corporations that make a profit but allow unions and non-profit corporations to make political contributions is an example of that.
Well, with the foreign donations, everyone seems to be getting their share, at least both sides seem to be getting their share.
Well, I'm not preaching about it either, Michelle. I think there is clearly a need to specify what do people mean when they say foreign donation.
Now, on the question of the disclosure of donations, I think that there's increasing support, including from your own side, people like Arthur Sinodinos, for real-time disclosure. Mm. Would you agree that there's an emerging consensus on this, and would you like to see that done?
And that's also covered in the reference I've given the Electoral Matters Committee. The current disclosure regime approach was set up many years ago when technology was very different. And I've indicated in the past that I think even the movement of technology allows for more regular donation disclosures. And I think that is something that, you know, I'm very open to looking at. However, we do also need to keep in mind that political parties are voluntary organisations and different parties are structured different ways. So we need to ensure that the regime we put in place takes account of the fact that there are hundreds and hundreds of Liberal Party branches, for example, in my home state of Victoria, that might only handle several thousand dollars each in some years or in non-election years. So we have to ensure that we don't place too great a burden on what are effectively voluntary associations. But I think technology does allow us to consider more regular disclosure than the current system we have in place.
And for all intents and purposes, real time?
Well, I don't want to commit to anything.
At least with the bigger donations.
I don't want to commit to anything specifically because I don't want to inadvertently create an expectation that the voluntary, that a small contribution to a branch made up of volunteers in one state somehow might need to be disclosed in as timely way as a more significant donation to a central organisation. But I think, as I've said before, that technology allows us to move to a more regular disclosure regime, the exact terms of which, I think that's something the Electoral Matters Committee is intent on looking at.
Malcolm Turnbull has reiterated his personal view that he would like ideally to see donations just from people on the electoral roll, that corporations and unions were not donors. Do you, from what you said before, it does seem you don't share that view. You said you were comfortable with companies donating.
When the PM made those comments recently, he did also include the proviso that the High Court has made recent judgments in this area. And there are a couple of cases out in New South Wales that mean that we have to identify an issue that the regulation of political donations and political speech and political activity is trying to address. And what I'm indicating is that my starting point is I am not convinced that banning all bodies corporate from making contributions is necessary.
Or even legal.
I'm not a lawyer, but I do think there are now, particularly with those two cases out of New South Wales, the Prime Minister's original comments were from more than a decade ago. The High Court has since made two particular determinations that I think make that particular approach more difficult than people might have thought a decade ago, including myself.
In the wake of the election, there's been a fair bit of agitation, I think, on your side of politics about the role of GetUp in particular and these third-party campaigns. Yet Liberals are always saying that business should be out there running campaigns and spruiking the government side. What's the difference? Isn't there double standards here?
No, the point I've made about this, and I approach this from a key principles point of view, is that one of the reasons we seek transparency on political contributions, because it's not just donations, it's also things like affiliation fees and fees for other arrangements and services, is that we want to know who's influencing our political process. Now, political parties are granted two particular privileges under the law, one of which is to nominate and endorse people for Parliament, and the other major one is public funding. Now, but we don't just regulate the activities of political parties for those purposes. We regulate them to ensure that we know who's making contributions so that there is some transparency. One of the big changes over the last decade has been the role of third-party groups and single-issue groups in campaigning. Some of them are treated differently for tax purposes. They can have tax deductible or gift recipient status. But it is fair to say that they are not regulated to the same degree of transparency as political parties. And I've made it very clear I'm not proposing a particular regime. But when I look at the United States, something that I have followed, they do have relatively tight regulations on candidates in some places and political parties. But since the Citizens United decision, there is a very different regime that applies to groups that are campaigning due to the political protection of the constitutional protection of speech in the US system. So what I have said is that I think we need to be careful to not inadvertently create a system whereby we regulate political parties and contributions to them, but we are not looking at the fact that third parties, single issue groups, can also have a direct and substantial impact on election campaigns and therefore election results. So without specifying any group in particular, I think that we need to actually look at this from the point of view is who is having impact on political campaigns, who is undertaking campaign activity, and start from that principle and work back.
So what you're saying is that the situation of these groups, these third parties, should be more transparent?
Well, there's varying, depending on the group and depending on the regulatory regime they operate under and depending on some of their own voluntary behaviours, there are different levels of transparency that apply. But at the moment, our system tends to be to regulate political parties and their associated entities, but because they are traditionally the main political campaign actors, so to speak. Whereas I think we have to look at the change that's happened over the last decade and see that they're not necessarily the sole actors in a political campaign anymore. And if we want to know what contributions are going into our political system, then I think we do need to look at what is happening to other campaigning organisations.
Of course, the contributions to an outfit like GetUp are often quite modest contributions that would fall well under the disclosure regime for political parties, aren't they?
And again, that's why I'm proposing no particular model here, but I do think that it is important that we don't have an inconsistency between some political actors and other political actors in terms of transparency. Some donations to these groups are actually also quite large.
Now, clearly, the vibe is that there'll be tougher authorisation requirements in future elections after some of the controversy over the Medicare texts and so on. But I wonder whether you think that truth in advertising is something that needs to be addressed. In previous years, I think the Liberals were very wary of this when it was called for by some on the different part of the political spectrum, but Mediscare might have changed your view?
Well, it's included in the reference at a particular request of some of the crossbenchers, and I was keen to accommodate in the reference the Minister gives as many particular issues as those as members of Parliament wanted covered, because the committee is a very important one. So it's there for consideration and deliberation by the committee. My personal view is I require a lot of convincing, because in politics, unlike in, say, a commercial transaction where we do have consumer law that protects people from misleading conduct, politics is a lot more about opinion and interpretation of fact. So I think we need to be careful to not have a system that would end up in people needing more lawyers to argue the case of whether something's true or not, that would distract from the fact that this is a political contest. So I maintain an open mind, but I'd need a lot of convincing to go down the path of further regulating political speech.
Now, just turning to the Senate, it certainly contains a very diverse and colourful...
It's long been that way, I understand.
A lot of crossbenchers this time. What are the signs, the early signs, that in this Parliament the government can get along with the Senate better than it did last time?
Well, we are only 2 weeks in, and I've got to say that my dealings thus far, I missed the first week of Parliament due to a personal circumstance, but in my dealings with the members of the Senate crossbench, since the new Parliament have all been very productive, have shown a willingness to talk. The reference to the Electoral Matters Committee includes a number of issues that members of the Senate crossbench and the opposition were keen to have included. I've found the mood to be one that is one that people are seeking, at least in the first instance, where there can be some common ground. We're not going to agree on everything, but I think if I could be a touch optimistic, there seems to be an effort to find those areas where we might agree rather than focus on the areas where we might not.
Just finally, I want to ask you about discipline in the Senate, because, of course, the government was rather shaken when it lost those divisions in the lower house, and Christopher Pyne seems to have brought in a very tough boarding school regime, monitors on the doors and so on. Now, we are in a minority in the Senate. There's also always the problem of numbers. You've got to collect others to get things through and also have all your own people present. How does it work there? Do you have monitors stopping people racing off?
As long as people aren't reading about it, that means it's working. Look, one of the things that's drilled into you from the first day you arrive in the Senate is that every vote matters, because the government has never had a big significant majority. Even in the 2 years from 2005 to 2007, when the coalition government had a majority, it was effectively of one or two, with an extra vote. 39-37. So it's one thing that it's drilled into you as a senator. And I have been present when one colleague did miss a vote.
And what happened to him or her?
It was not pleasant. but what happened was the Senate recommitted the vote, but this colleague needed to sort of sit down and effectively apologise to the Senate and then have a little bit of a free character assessment on the floor of the House. And so that, I think that there's also another thing in the Senate, which I've availed myself of in the last couple of weeks, which I'm not sure how long it goes back, but there is a standing pair arrangement in the Senate that well predates my time, and I'm told is very long-standing. But I think it goes to that issue that the minute you arrive in the Senate, you know that every vote matters. And also, without knowing the House as well, the votes can happen at any time, whereas I know in the House they can have periods where there are lots of votes and then periods where there aren't. So
you're saying they're more slack down there?
Not at all. I would not dare say that. All I would say is that us senators know the importance of being there when the bells ring. but look, it's just a reflection of the fact that, you know, even before the current Senate and the one before, there's never been a situation where either side has had a significant majority in the Senate.
Scott Ryan, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Thanks for listening.